Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This episode of Ramble Meets is sponsored by Bet365.
James Horncastle, football writer and broadcaster, and Gazzetta Football Italia baby.
James, it's a pleasure to have you here. And I'm not being sarcastic for once. It is. Lots of people have lots of different paths into football writing, football broadcasting, being a part of football media. How do you come to be here today?
Look, I never wanted to be anything else, I suppose. I found other careers to be boring. I remember at university, you know, where they had the careers fair, and it's usually big corporate companies that come and want you to attract you into insurance and to go and work for their law firm.
Yeah.
I just never spent any time in them. Didn't dwell, just walked on, because ultimately I wanted to write, I wanted to travel, and I wanted to, I mean, my passion was always Italian football, and I haven't compromised on that. I remember applying for the traineeship at The Guardian, where they would take on a young journalist on the sports desk every year.
What age were you then? Were you out of university then?
I think I was maybe 20, 21. But I got interviewed, I didn't get it. I was gutted because I really wanted to work on that sports desk.
Yeah.
And I then went to work in the Observer Sports Monthly with Jonathan Liu at the time. And this was before the OSM got closed.
It was when the Observer used to do a different magazine every week, right?
Yeah.
They rotate through food and sport and music.
And that was fantastic.
Yeah.
Because it did broaden my mind in terms of wouldn't it be great to do what Tim Lewis, the editor at the time, was doing, which was, you know, going to interview Novak Djokovic and do like photo shoots with them in a tuxedo in a swimming pool, which looked amazing. But, you know, my kind of remit then was writing about bike locks and stuff like that, which didn't really float my boat.
But you've got to start somewhere, right?
You've got to start somewhere. And that was brilliant, just being around that environment. But I've never kind of wanted to be anybody else. My love from the get-go was for, you know, watching Serie A, watching Channel 4 on a Saturday morning and a Sunday afternoon, to catch the games when they were broadcast in the UK. And, I don't know, wanting to experience that kind of, wanting to escape where I grew up, which was Hull, which isn't a knock on Hull.
No, it's the way you say that.
Because, I grew up in Hull at a time when it was in the national news for being voted the crappiest town and being, the front cover of that kind of book that was seemed to be very popular at the time, you know, kind of Sunday Times bestseller, Crap Towns, and Hull always seemed to be top of that, which I think is shameful, really.
European city of culture now, that's what's had the last laugh.
Well, it was, exactly, and that was magnificent. Yeah. You know, I've never really forgiven Kirsty Allsop and Phil, that guy. But I think they did a show which was essentially, you know, highlighting, you know, how crap these towns are. Well, in actual fact, you know, they've contributed so much culturally to the UK and beyond. Hmm. But I didn't want to stick.
At the same time, you wanted to leave as quick as you could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I love going back. Yeah. But I wanted to get away. And, you know, I mean, my fortune really was at university meeting my wife, Caroline. And she'd been and lived in Rome for a year before going to university. And she got there and she was like, I don't want to be here, you know, because her university experience, which, you know, a lot of people might be able to kind of relate to, is you meet loads of friends, they become your best friends pretty much from then for the rest of your lives. You go out, you have a lot of fun. She'd had all of that in Rome. And every sort of half term, every end of year, we would go back to Rome to see her friends. And then when we graduated, we went and lived there. And that was very much my kind of, yeah, I had this passion for Italian football, but my passion for life and living in Italy and experiencing everything there, you know, all kind of came out of that. Because, you know, at that time, I did history at university. I loved kind of researching, looking into backstories, the history of all kinds of different countries, states, whatever. And but I'd never taken really to languages when I was at school, for example. I always found the way of teaching them to be not particularly engaging. And, you know, it was only when I was out living in Italy, I did go to school there at the time to learn Italian, but it was the kind of full immersion being there, and then more or less learning kind of getting kind of football speak Italian from just buying the newspapers every day, Gazzetta dello Sport, Corriere dello Sport, and navigating it through there, and then, you know, various jobs, and, you know, of course having your sort of your pipes burst in your flat and having to call a plumber and that sort of thing.
What is it about Italian football in the first instance that you liked so much?
Okay, so I mean, when I was growing up in Hull, Hull is a great rugby league city. And my uncle played rugby league for Hull KR. I played rugby from the ages of 8 to 16. I didn't play football.
Right.
And I kind of grew up in a family where the sport, the number one sport, was cycling. So I mean, that's another thing that I'm hugely passionate about is, you know, at the moment, for example, last week it was the Milan San Remo. I love all the classics, the monuments. I love the Tour, the Giro. And that was something my dad was really enthusiastic about. But I kind of chose football. I don't know whether it's because I wanted to be different within my own family, you know, a bit counterculture. I always tried to be, I never liked to follow the crowd, I suppose. And then I would watch Gazzetta on Channel 4, And Hull at the time, yeah, Hull City were in the third division, which is League Two. Mm. And, you know, I had a season ticket, but it would mainly be to go and spend time with my friends. Mm. I suppose, yeah, watching Italian football, it was the diversity in terms of the colour of the shirts.
It's the exoticism of it.
The exoticism, yeah. the foreign players that were in the league at the time. Yeah. Compared with, say, the Premier League, where, you know, most of the foreign players were from Sweden and Norway. You know, you had Gabriel Batistuta, Edmundo, Rui Costa. I'm just naming players at Fiorentina, but like all of those guys. And again, just the idea. What I really liked, and I think this maybe comes across in my punditry, is like it's not just about the football for me. It's about the locations, you know. Yeah, I remember, you know, you'd watch James Richardson in these various different places across Italy, and just how different they are. And it still strikes me. I was in Milan for the Milan Derby a few weeks ago, and you'll be walking sort of up, I don't know, Corso Vittorio Emanuele, and then you'll just see the Duomo, you know, at the end of the street. It's massive, incredible cathedral, and just still takes my breath away. It doesn't really get old, and for me, it's the full package. Again, I went to talk to a Scottish player who's at Hellas Verona at the moment, Liam Henderson, and I think one of the things that he said, which, you know, really spoke to me, was how there are no modern football fans in Italy. They're all old school,
right? Okay.
You know, that's a good and a bad thing, you know, in terms of the atmosphere that they create. But there is this sense that it's a very kind of pure, visceral, raw kind of form of supporting and following football there, which appealed to me, and still appeals to me. You always get engaged on social media in these kind of debates about, you know, what's the best league, people find various ways of deciding what's the best. For me, it's purely on a kind of sentimental and lifestyle point of view. I just love Italy and Italian football. I love all things Italian. I mean, that's the thing for me. I love going to different cities, different regions, trying different plates of food. Mm. I love Italian music, Italian cinema. I'm big into trap, you know, trash rap at the moment.
So we go back to when you're living in Italy. Mm. How did you first get into what you're doing now? Are you sending emails to UK publications saying, "Look, I'm based in Italy, but I'm English. I can give you information on all this"? Because when we spoke to Andy Brassel, obviously our colleague from on the continent, he said he saw an advertisement and he thought to write for Champions Magazine, the Champions League magazine, which is now defunct. And he said, "I didn't have the qualifications, but I thought I could do it." And then they took me on a freelance basis. So how does it all actually start for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that Andy mentioned Champions. Champions is a great magazine. And the editor, Paul Simpson.
It's not going anymore, right? So I'm right when I say it's defunct.
I think it is defunct. It was made by Haymarket, who produced, they did produce 442 before. I think it was recently bought out. But Paul Simpson, the editor there, was a great kind of European football sympathizer, loved it. And I think UEFA were the guys who basically contracted them to make that magazine. But you could write about all kinds of things, you know, about Saint-Étienne in the 1970s and all that sort of thing. Yeah. Anyway, I would pitch to them as well.
You just thought, right, I'm going to start pitching to get writing work at these different magazines.
Well, as I said, all I wanted to do was write about Italian football. So I would write to anyone who would allow me to do that. Okay.
Paid or unpaid?
I would always look to get paid. Yeah. And if there's anyone...
So even back then you were like that, were you?
You have to.
I know, I'm not blaming you.
But anyone who's listening to this, you know, don't do unpaid internships or don't, you know, if you're submitting an article, I would always look to try and get paid.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, if you don't, you know, that means your work's either worthless and it brings everyone else's wages down as well, because they think they can get it cheaper.
Yeah.
But so I'd write for. I remember growing up again watching Gazzetta, and they produced a magazine for many, many years around Football Italia, called Football Italia, and they would occasionally get interviews, and I would write for them as well. I'd write for Football Italia website.
Did you actually know your stuff then, though?
I've always backed myself. Like,
yeah, okay.
I mean, yeah. No, I think I am very anoraki about Italian football. I mean, if you've been to my flat, I mean, my kind of office there is just full of... I've got like 1950s, 1960s Panini albums, which have been completed by other people, which I bought in flea markets in Milan.
Right, okay.
I remember when I was living in Italy, they produced this fantastic series. Gazette, all the Italian sports papers, they produce, they sell all kinds of just trashy kind of things with the newspaper to get you to buy this, particularly the Sunday or the Saturday kind of supplement kind of things.
Yeah.
And I would buy every week. The Gazette would do a DVD called, Campionato Io Ti Amo. League, I love you.
Right. Okay.
It's like kind of like Lamp, love Lamp.
Okay. Right.
But they did every season from 1974 up until 2010 when I was there, and every week a new one would come out, and right. I would go and buy it, and these DVDs would be like 5 hours long, and
there's enough footage from back in the '70s of all these games.
So much. Yeah. So okay. much, and they would tie it in with. I don't know, whatever the front pages of Gazzetta were in, you know, match day one of 1974-75 and all that sort of thing. And I would just consume all of that.
So you had this basis of knowledge in the first place because you were just so into it.
Also, I just had a hunger to learn, you know? Yeah. It's like anything. That's the other thing. I would say that when I was learning Italian, and this goes back to what I'd recommend everyone to do, learning a language is the best thing I ever did. And I didn't do it. Well, I did go to school and learn the kind of fundamentals. Going to school in Hull, for example, where I was being taught Spanish, French, and German, I just never could get passionate about the way it was being taught to me. So, what I would recommend anyone to do is, if you have a passion, be it football or not, be it music, be it cinema, you know, buy magazines, buy books in, or listen to music in that language and learn from there, you know. So I'd buy, I don't know, biographies of Giovanni Trapattoni or stuff like that, and you know, I'd have a pen or a highlighter, and any kind of word that I didn't understand or whatever, I just either highlight it or put a ring around it, and then obviously go and put it in the dictionary and then
find out
and that sort of thing. Yeah. But in terms of starts, I would pitch to everyone. I mean, Sheridan Bird, who we all know, he used to work on staff at Champions. Sheridan now lives in Milan. He had a kind of passion for Italian football like I do, and he would listen to my ideas and then take them into the kind of production meeting, I suppose, with Paul Simpson and get them commissioned. I'd write to 442. I'd do the same thing. I remember interviewing Carlo Ancelotti really early on when he was at Chelsea with 442, and that was purely because they knew I spoke Italian, they knew I had a passion for that, and so they went to me when that opportunity presented itself. They thought, well, that's something that we can maybe use James for, and that was still, I'd say, pretty early on in my career.
You must have been nervous.
Yeah, no, I was sat in a small room in Cobham, which didn't have any windows in it. And it was kind of painted sort of, it was like white breeze blocks. And all there was like a chair in there. It was like an interrogation room. And I can remember actually shaking whilst I did that.
Just one-on-one?
Just one-on-one.
Yeah.
And to be fair to Chelsea, Steve Atkins, the communications officer at the time, he wasn't like some other press officer. He wasn't in the room with a watch, kind of stopwatch, like start and go.
Yeah.
He stayed outside and then knocked after 20, 25 minutes or whatever it was. But I was shake his Carlo. I mean, Carlo's massive, huge name, you know.
Yeah.
I remember, again, one of my sort of first gigs was chasing Marcello Lippi around Benny Hill style at Earl's Court with Paolo Bandini and Rory Smith. I think it was Rory. I'm pretty sure. It feels like a long time ago now. But, we'd all been sort of promised one-on-one sit-down interviews, and then it soon became apparent that we were not going to get one-on-one interviews. I remember I remember Lippi at one stage being really exasperated, saying, "Ma cosa devo fare? Ma cosa devo fare?" He's like, "What do I have to do, for God's sake?" And it's like having to persuade him, basically, to give us, like, I don't know, 5 minutes.
Do you think Carlo picked up on the fact that you were nervous?
Carlo really appreciated the fact that I spoke to him and did the interview in Italian.
Yeah,
and I spoke.
But your Italian was good enough at that point.
Yeah, I probably made some horrendous mistakes.
Yeah.
I think he appreciated it. He also liked the fact that he was at Chelsea, but I asked him, this is something I always do, because I lived in Rome and I used to go to Roma. I used to go to Lazio games as well, but I used to go to a lot of Roma games. I was always passionate about Roma and their history. And I remember asking him about his playing career there, what it was like to play with Agostino Di Bartolomei, what it was like to have Nils Liedholm as a coach. And he loved that.
Yeah.
You know, he came out of it and he wasn't expecting it. He wasn't expecting an English guy to speak to him in Italian. He wasn't expecting an English guy to be talking to him about Nils Liedholm and Agostino Di Bartolomei.
So the barriers have been knocked down just by the fact that you've come across like you've really made an effort, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And
at no point did you have to break back into English? Say, I don't understand that.
No, no.
Because presumably one of the barriers to learning the language and working in that language is that native speakers can speak it quite quickly, and there's lots of different things that, you know, there's a never-ending amount of things to learn, right?
Look, I think you just have to be confident. Again, going back to like learning languages at school, there'd be always this kind of, you know, how important pronunciation is and nailing, and that is important. But sometimes you can actually, and I don't do this, but I know other people who do, you can speak another language almost in a kind of very flat English accent. But if you do it with confidence and you're grammatically correct, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
I tend to like, you know, try to Roma it up a bit. But yeah. And my wife, again, is just incredible when it comes to, she speaks like essentially she's from Rome, even though she's, yeah, you know, my wife's English. So you
had a decent experience with Carlo Ancelotti and a comedy experience with Marcello Lippi. Has there been any sort of situations where you've thought this isn't going well, or oh my god, this guy's a complete dickhead, or something like that, you know, where it's been like a challenging situation to speak to someone in your line of work?
I remember one of the first things that I did was I went to speak to Marco Materazzi after he'd been in court, I think, to try and he was, I think, suing some of the papers over here for misreporting what he'd allegedly said to Zinedine Zidane in the World Cup final.
Oh, okay, yeah, I remember. Yeah, okay.
And I think he was successful in anyway some of those, but it was my first experience of what it's like to have an Italian press officer.
Yeah,
be present during an interview.
Is this another one-on-one?
This was a one-on-one, yeah, and this was quite bizarre because we started the interview and it was on camera, and Materazzi had a shirt and a blazer on, but his the collar was sticking out over the blazer rather than inside the blazer.
Right.
And we started the interview. I think we were maybe one or two questions in, and the Italian press officer saw this. I was like, no, and then kind of went over and like sort of opened his blazer up, tucked the shirt collar in, and put that back
was
in.
Was this a TV interview?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So Sartori is very important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And almost like mummed him a little bit in terms of like, you know, there's maybe a little like kind of rogue eyebrow hair.
Yeah.
So, you know, sort of just like, you know, sort of licked his thumb and then just smoothed it over.
Yeah.
Like that. So that was a bit disorientating.
What did the Matrix do?
Oh, that was normal.
Yeah. But no one's ever really sort of been that difficult. Yeah.
No, I mean, I've been quite lucky, to be honest.
It's because you're so genteel, mate. That's why.
Well, no, I mean, I suppose I tend to, and this maybe has sometimes got me into trouble because I don't always go for the newsy angle. You know, maybe what they've been prepared for and what they're expecting. And I'll always try and go off the beaten track with a player or a coach. When I suppose, you know, and again, this goes back to my experience with Ancelotti. I remember him saying that for him, it was quite easy to deal with the media here because all they ever wanted to talk about was kind of personality clashes.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's like, it's Ancelotti against Wenger
and
all this sort of thing. And he was like, well, what can I say other than, you know, Wenger's had a great career.
Yeah.
I respect him a lot.
Whereas in Italy, they would probably drill you more about tactics. And
yeah, they'd be like, why did you play Pirlo on the left-hand side of midfield against this guy when, you know he's better in sort of a position in front of the defence? Why did you make this change here in minute 73?
Mm.
Shouldn't you be, are the balls fully pumped up? They look like they were deflated today, Carlo, and all that sort of thing. Why is the pitch in that kind of condition?
Right. Yeah, so it's a bit more arduous.
It's very granular. I always think if you ask tactical questions here, and you know, I think Michael Cox can probably relate to this. You ask specific tactical questions here. It's often kind of something that you just get shut down on. You know, it's like move on. We need to actually get to the bottom of what happened with Mesut Ozil. You know, so
it's just a bit different.
But
All right, time for a quick break, James. Don't go anywhere, guys. When we come back, we'll spend a bit more time talking to James Horncastle. What a treat.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Okay, welcome back to this episode of Ramble Meets, sponsored by Bet365. I am still here with James. James, beforehand, you were just talking a little bit about people you've interviewed. Have you ever, I understand very early in your career, interviewing Carlo Ancelotti was a big deal. Have you ever sort of looked around where you are now and thought, oh, I've made it?
I never think I've made it.
There's no moment you thought, well, this is amazing, and you've taken the moment to smell the roses. Not in like an arrogant way, but just as in like, well, I've worked really hard to get it. This is great.
I think I'm very lucky.
Was it when Italy didn't qualify for the World Cup?
Initially that was a lot of work.
Yeah.
Particularly when they went...
Picking over the bones.
When they... The first game against Sweden, and then obviously the fallout from the second. Yeah, that was a very intense period for me. But now I'm extremely fortunate because I get to do what I want to do. I would pay to do this job, you know, and I get paid to do it, which I'm very... privilege.
Caroline wouldn't let you do that.
No, absolutely not. No. But I suppose, you know, whenever I get to go to a big game, you know, be it a Milan derby, and I mean, I always find this, and I can completely understand why fans, listeners, followers don't get this, but we'll often get asked on social media, you know, about, you know, where to go and buy tickets or where's the best place to sit. And you know, I can relate to that from my time in Rome when, you know, if I was going to watch a Roma game at the Stadio Olimpico, I'd buy a ticket for the Distinti Sud or something like that. But yeah, journalists don't really have the answers to these questions because, you know, we apply for press accreditation.
Yeah.
We get that accreditation if we're lucky, and then we get to sit in the press stand.
Yeah.
And
so you feel very fortunate to be in that position, is what you mean?
Yeah. No, it's crazy, really. Mm. From being a guy in Hull who used to, I suppose, I remember going to York one day, and this was in a time where you would buy a Championship Manager, and it would be, it wouldn't be for all the leagues. It had to be only for one league.
Yeah.
And I bought the Serie A one.
Right.
And again, being, you know, from being the kid who was playing that to, I suppose, being able to go to, yeah, all over the country. To, yeah, like I mean, I went to Sassuolo in October, and yeah, just to go to this small village in Emilia Romagna, which doesn't have a, or hadn't until recently had a big football tradition, I suppose, because you usually associate in that part of the world with Parma, Bologna, Spal from what they did in the '60s. But to go to places like that and talk to people who work for those clubs, and see the conditions in which they train, and you know, some of the guys who've been there for years, I always, that is the part of the job I enjoy most, I suppose.
How has football changed since you started covering it? How, what are the big changes? I mean,
in terms of reporting,
well, the game's just moved on in a huge way, and in lots of different ways since we both started, you know, working, doing this sort of thing. Well, so, what are the sort of most obvious changes?
In terms of work, I mean, I remember when I started out, Italian football was still big. A lot of the legendary or Hall of Famers were still playing there.
Yeah.
They would, you know, you'd see Milan get to the Champions League final in 05 and 07. You'd see Inter win the treble in 2010, and I would say at that time, editors were prepared to listen and commission to stories from all up and down the league, you know, be it this tiny club that had just got promoted and all that sort of thing, and they commissioned features on that. Whereas now, and I think it's changing, it's beginning to go back that way, but there's certainly been a period where it's, you know, we want to know about Juventus.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
We want to know about...
Are you talking about British publications here or Italian ones?
No, I would say sort of international media. Yeah, so, I mean, I work a lot for ESPN in the States.
Yeah.
And but I think this is true of anyone now, really. It's very much, we want to know about Real Madrid and Barcelona.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take content on them, you know, every hour, every day.
Yeah.
Same when it comes to the Manchester United, Arsenal, Liverpool, Chelsea, Spurs, City now, certainly. Because, I mean, that's been really interesting working in TV, seeing what clubs rate highest when it comes to, you know, audience numbers.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Bayern, Dortmund, Juventus, AC Milan, Inter. And that's it. And it's that collection of clubs which,
yeah.
Yeah, they want content about, they want to know about, they want to, yeah, see what these clubs are doing either in the transfer. I mean, that's what I would say has really kind of intensified with social media probably since 2010-11.
But do you think the UK has become, you know, take the political situation aside, but in terms of football, do you think the UK has become more Europhilic?
Yeah, because I think they've got more access to it than ever before.
Yeah.
And people are more knowledgeable about it. You know, they can go on YouTube and watch clips. And
so has that made your job harder because you've got to know more?
Has it made my job harder?
You get more people pulling you up on things and asking you more in-depth questions about it and all that kind of stuff.
I'd say I'm luckier than, say, some of my colleagues who report on the Premier League.
Right.
Because everyone in this country has an opinion on the Premier League and their club. They know their club inside out. Whereas if I'm reporting on something that's happening in Italy in the English language, yeah, a lot of people maybe don't have the same familiarity, don't have the same day-to-day kind of knowledge of what's going on at that club or what's been going on with that player. So they tend to be less aggressive. Obviously, if you make a glaring mistake, which, you know, touch wood, doesn't happen often, but does happen every now and again, then you will get pulled up on it. But it's... reporting on a foreign league in English language, I think there's generally kind of people are going to you to learn and see to find out a different side of the game, because yeah, if you're an Arsenal fan, you know, you'll you know, watch every Arsenal game, you'll read, I don't know, Ars blog, listen to the Ars cast and all that sort of thing, and just
The thing, but I think people don't understand often enough is that, you know, if you're covering football in general, or maybe whether it's Italian football or English football or whatever, you're never going to know a club as well as someone who supported it all their life and who's a season ticket holder there, who remembers everything about it. And also, it's not necessarily that relevant to have that much overload of knowledge for the job you do. You need to know a bit, and you need to know about the situation you're talking about and the context of it and all the rest of it. But you're not sitting there in presumably in your your back pocket. I don't know, maybe you are. I'm certainly not. Where you've got the full first 11 lineup of Roma in a cup final in 1974 or something. You'd have to go and find that, right?
Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah. I could name you this sort of, 83 Roma team and that sort of thing. That's
the difference between you and me, I think. One of the many differences between you and I guess. Have you seen the homogenisation of the game, though, across Europe? Because I know you do a little bit of stuff on France and Germany, all that kind of stuff. Have you seen like a homogenisation of the football going experience?
Yeah, I suppose so. In terms of, you go to certainly big clubs in Europe, and it is very much the kind of, you get the same experience. Slightly different nuances, I would say. Every club has their own identity.
Yeah,
but certainly sort of goal music. And things like that. I mean, that's one of the things why that's what I love about Italian football, is that even if a lot of the games don't sell out, you'll have a pocket of hardcore ultras who have their own kind of shtick, and they
other people have said to me that the clubs around Europe want to replicate what they're doing in the Premier League.
Yeah, well, and I think that's right, in terms of certainly from an Italian perspective, they want the game to look good on TV, and by that they mean
full stadium.
You have to have full full stadium, and at the moment in Italy, for example, there's a big debate about what the Milan clubs are going to do with San Siro. Are they going to demolish it? Which looks like they want to build their own stadium on the car park adjacent to San Siro. Mm. And there was a debate about this yesterday, and Juventus president Andrea Agnelli was asked, "Do you regret building the Allianz Stadium with a capacity of only 41,000? Because you could probably sell out much bigger." And he's like, "No, we don't want to just sell out for the big games. We want to sell out for every single game." It looks great on TV.
Yeah.
And that makes the league more appealing, because I suppose this is the other thing, is that these days all leagues have global audiences, and that you can't always appeal to the guy in Rome or the guy in Parma who supports Roma or Parma and that sort of thing. You have to think bigger than that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a major factor these days.
It's a kind of a balance to strike, isn't it? Because that you want the people... Because one of the things that the Premier League has done very well has been able to attract fans of clubs from all over the world, right? Mm. So it's a thing to balance, because clearly Juventus want those valuable other fans in China and the US to look at that stadium and go, well, that's amazing, I'd love to be a part of that. But at the same time, they know realistically those people are never going to consistently be a part of that.
Yeah.
So you've almost got to cater for the fans on your doorstep and those far-reaching fans at the same time.
Yeah,
no, and football, that's new in football, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
That wasn't really a concern until maybe the Premier League sort of blazed that trail a while back.
Absolutely. I think it's now about appealing to as many people as possible. I think we're seeing this in how the game is diversifying. You look at the kind of growth of women's football. I remember when Juventus rebranded themselves and they launched this new logo, which caused a bit of controversy at the time.
I remember
the kind of the blurb that they put out was they want to appeal to, sort of young women and kids in Mexico and the US and all that sort of thing.
It feels like it has to be a universal, broad sort of branding.
Yeah.
So when you say football clubs have to diversify, it's probably a good time to talk about where you think the football is going then. What direction is it going in? I mean, because... it's unrecognizable really from when we first started watching it.
Yeah.
So what direction do you think it's traveling? What are the biggest concerns, the next, the crocodiles nearest the boat for football in the future?
I think it's been quite interesting listening to Andrea Agnelli and some of the other big stakeholders in the European game in the last week, because there's the European Club Association met and they've already signed this memorandum of understanding with UEFA about what to do, and it looks as though it's kind of killed a European Super League dead.
Right.
But I think in 2024, what we'll see is maybe games get played on a weekend. Maybe they'll look to...
European games, European competition games.
UEFA games played on a weekend. I think a lot of that is going to come down to restructuring the international calendar. in terms of, for example, you look at the disdain that the ECA and I think UEFA have shown to FIFA's decision to kind of, they want to expand the Club World Cup.
That's right, yeah.
It's like, no, yeah, that's just taking away sort of, that's just going to congest the international calendar more. And
are we destined to be caught in between a big tug of war between UEFA and the clubs and FIFA and the international?
I think UEFA and the clubs at the moment look kind of on the same page.
No, but I just mean they're on one side, and then you've got the international game on the other side. And because clearly a lot of what FIFA are doing, to me at least, to the layman, seems that they're just trying to wrestle as much control and as much power back from the clubs who they believe have become too powerful.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think
the Nations League would be an example of that, presumably.
Oh, the Nations League's been a massive
but that's
success.
UEFA, right?
That's UEFA. Yeah. And I think it's quite interesting now that there's the European qualifiers, and the qualifiers, it's like going back to what the old international calendar looked like, and getting people enthusiastic and engaged in that has been, I think, been a challenge. But I think essentially for all this to happen in terms of let's say Champions League games to be played on the weekend, the current fixture list needs to be streamlined, both in terms of international games for countries, but also I think, in England, I think you have 52 domestic games. Mm. You've got your league games, you've got your FA Cup games, you've got your League Cup games. In Germany, I think you've only got 40.
Right.
40 games, because you've got a league that have got fewer participants, or 18 teams rather than 20. And you've only got one cup competition.
But how do UEFA, for example, reconcile that idea of playing European games on the weekend with, say, the Premier League?
I think the Premier League is in an interesting position because obviously it makes so much more money than everybody else. But even we've reached a saturation point in terms of if you look at the recent TV deals, they're for less money than they were in the past.
A lot of people believe they're going to bring that in-house and start and not sell it to broadcasters, they're just going to Netflix it themselves, basically.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of leagues are looking at doing that. That was one of the things that I think Serie A was looking to do when one of the, let's say, the BT Sport of Italy decided to withdraw and pull out. It's like, we need to start moving towards creating, essentially go direct to consumer rather than, go with one of these big major broadcasters. I think we will see something like that. Yeah. Coming up, sort of a Netflix for sport. We're already seeing that that company Otro. I don't know if you've come across this, where they're producing a lot of just kind of bespoke footballer content. Where
they've got a lot of football players on board signed onto it, haven't they?
You can watch Zinedine Zidane talk for 3 hours.
Yeah,
with my colleague Julien Laurent.
You've presumably done that, have you?
No,
you've already got that on VHS, have you?
No, but I'm interested to see how these. What the business plan for these sort of companies is, really. What do they think that... Is that a reflection of a new generation of football fans coming through and supporting individuals rather than clubs?
Yeah.
Because you see that more and more in the States, where, there will be tabs on newspapers or news sites which are kind of just dedicated to, say, LeBron. And, for example, my experience over the last year with Cristiano Ronaldo moving to Juventus within the limits of what you can report about him in the current circumstances, that is very much what is Cristiano Ronaldo doing.
They become one man industries of their own, right? Yeah.
Has he opened a hair transplant clinic?
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. Has he opened a new hotel? These things, just people will click for anything Ronaldo based, and I'm sure it's the same with Messi.
But that doesn't make it the game any less a team sport, though. That's off the pitch, though, right? That's obviously slightly different, I suppose. On the idea that leagues could take out the middleman and just broadcast directly to fans, that to me, if you crunch like rudimentary numbers, that becomes like a no-brainer quite quickly.
Yeah.
Because if you fix yourself in a deal for, say, 7 billion quid or whatever it is for the next 4 years, that's an obscene amount of money by most people's standards. But the Premier League, for their part, know that that's the maximum they're going to earn in that way for that period of time. Whereas, obviously, the if they just put it straight to market, it's only limited by the amount of people that want to get involved.
Yeah.
And then their own technology.
Well, also, I mean, before...
How would that affect the game, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it would skew it even more if, for example, let's say even clubs just became the owners of their own rights and were able to sell their games and stuff like that. Because you see, I mean, the league would have to oversee that. But I think we're already seeing it with the latest foreign TV deal for the Premier League, where they've looked to the Big Six have essentially said, yeah,
we want a slightly more...
We want more money for that because people abroad are watching. So, it has the potential to skew competitive balance even more. And I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for the game, how it realigns in order to keep people interested. Because I think while the Champions League in the knockout stages recently has just been amazing, I mean, it's been outstanding, kind of justifies some of the kind of... I wouldn't say a super league because this is a knockout format. You know, in a league, I don't think you would get the kind of same sort of drama that you're getting in the Champions League at the moment. But certainly how you keep, whether people are interested in still seeing, you know, maybe a Celtic or a Benfica challenging for the Champions League. Just in many ways that people look at Ajax at the moment and think one of the things that's so great about seeing Ajax compete is because they are one of the, you know, historic greats of this game. And the money and the economics are against them.
Yeah.
And
people love an underdog, don't they?
Yeah.
But is that shared in with Italy, where Italian football fans care as much about that?
Yeah, I think they don't want to be...
I thought it was just part of the British psyche.
No, I think they don't want... I mean, a lot of fans of clubs outside of Juventus don't want to be left behind.
Yeah.
You know? They still want to think that their teams can compete and win things. And the fact that this is such a recurring debate, you only have to look at how often managers cite, you know, how much, you know, this club turns over respect to Juventus, PSG, Man City, Man United, and all that sort of thing, to think, how do we bridge that gap? Because ideas will only go so far, and you know, you can have, you know, a great tactical scheme for 6 months, but within 6 months there'll be, you know, 10, 15 minutes videos of YouTube cutting that up, showing how you can, you know, break through it and all that sort of thing. And it's a copycat league and you move on.
And in many ways, that's not going to solve the issue of getting a league like Italy to compete with a league like the Premier League. The reason the Premier League is so powerful is because of the product. It's a branded, packaged up, incredibly effectively sold product.
Yeah.
And it feels like everything has mixed together at the right potent sort of brew. Busy stadiums, players at key times that have come here, you know, the way that the UK is very good at broadcasting in general, you know, the way they make good programming, all that kind of stuff. It's all together. It's all packaged up, isn't it?
Yeah. And this is the thing, I think a lot of people don't, well, particularly in the UK, won't be aware of this, but yeah, the Premier League has its own company, Premier League Productions, which is based in IMG Studios in near Heathrow. And they produce content every day for global broadcasting partners.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and we're occasionally guests.
Some of them, they scrape the barrel so much
so
that we even get involved.
It's always funny to find that one of the things that really struck me about the reach of the Premier League was being on there. I think it was an international week, and we were just going over players have been linked with Premier League clubs from abroad and all that sort of thing, how feasible you thought various moves are, and you have people watching in a bar in Nepal, with the Himalayas.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. That's the reach of it, though, right?
Or you're doing Fan Zone, where you're talking to people live from Zimbabwe about what they think about Maurizio Sarri at Chelsea.
Yeah, that's the power of the brand.
And I don't think I know La Liga has. They've tried to do sort of similar things. They have their own kind of press show where they get journos involved to go over the weekend's games. But the Premier League, when it comes to that. Yeah, they do their own. Yeah, you watch the guys on Match of the Day or Goals on Sunday and that sort of thing. Yeah, those pundits, Ian Wright, Alan Shearer, often on a Sunday, when they're not, because they're not on Sky, they'll be on PLP.
Yeah,
doing a half pre-match, halftime, full-time analysis of whatever the big game is in the Premier League, and that will be being broadcast in Nigeria, in India, and that sort of thing. The Premier League have just got it
sewn up
from the get-go.
Before we wrap up, because we're running out of time, what's the best experience you've had covering football in your job?
Oof.
Was it when Italy didn't qualify for the World Cup?
What's the best experience? I love going to interview players, being told to wait for players, and then getting to watch training.
Yeah, I bet.
I love that. Yeah. That's. I remember going to interview Justin Kluivert recently, and it was a wonderful afternoon. The sun was coming down. They had a small sided game going on, and you get to watch what these professionals, what their daily kind of work is like, I suppose. And I remember there was Stephen Nzonzi. I think one of his kids was there watching him, you know, in their Nzonzi shirt. And then, you know, he walked off as he was going to the dressing room, said hello to his kid. I just love the kind of daily, I suppose the daily life of
the behind the scenes kind of insight.
Getting the privilege. It's a real privilege to be able to see that.
Yeah.
In terms of going to a football game, I always remember one of my first experiences at the Stadio Olimpico, going to watch Roma Catania with my Swedish friend Dan, and we sat in the Distinti Sud. The great thing about sort of sitting in the Distinti Sud is you get to look into the Curva Sud. Where all the ultras sit, and how they were like rushing to the barriers, like this stampede, and you know, people falling over and all that sort of thing. They seem to be having the best time ever. And then coming out of the game afterwards, Catania fans not happy, I would say, after making the trip up from Sicily.
Yeah.
And you know, seeing sort of riot police, buses being turned over, things being set alight,
and you thought, this is a bit of me. This is a great experience. Yeah. Honestly, you must have
because I'm very Danny Dyer football. No, but
you must have thought this is quite interesting. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it was unlike any other kind of football experience. If say, you know, going to Boothroyd Park to watch Hull or going to Elland Road to watch Leeds.
Yeah.
It was unlike anything I'd kind of ever seen before. And you know, even that stage, I was like 20, 21, and it's that's. Yeah, I think that was like a kind of hot kind of spring day, and just you really felt the kind of heat in terms of, you know, atmosphere, kind of intensity, you know, which, you know, I don't think that's that experience is not for everyone. And certainly when people write to me and say, I remember there's one of the other things I do is on a Sunday, if I'm not in Italy covering a game, is that I'll go into IMG and help out with the production of the kind of Serie A World Feed highlights show and stuff like that. I remember one of the producers there was, he went to the Rome Derby in a couple of months ago, and he sent me an email saying kind of where can I buy tickets, what should I do before the game, how do I get to the stadium and all that sort of thing. And in the email it was very much kind of like, you know, if I do this, will I get beaten up? Or if I go down this route, will I get beaten up? You know, what are the risks and all this sort of thing? And to be honest, I've been very lucky covering Italian football for the last 10 years or so, 10, 12 years, in that, you know, I've seen violence, but I've never actually experienced it. But that is a lot of people's starting point. And again, that's something the Premier League has got over Serie A. Obviously, when people go to a Premier League game, they're not. That's not in their forefront of their mind, whereas it was with this colleague at IMG. But
what's next for you, James? Before we go, what's next? I mean, how close are you to that director of football job at Roma, which is presumably the sum total of all your efforts so far? Now Monchi's left. Is there a chance there for you, do you think?
No, I don't think there is. I think I think what's really interesting there is. Yeah, Roma tried to blend it, I suppose, and have a lot of algorithm kind of money ball sort of.
I don't want to talk about Roma. I want to talk about you. What's next about you?
Yeah, no, I'd love to write a book and finally get a book off the ground.
Good.
That's got to be my driving kind of force.
Well, I'm sure Football Ramble listeners everywhere and on the Constant listeners too, of course, will be queuing up in their droves to get a signed copy from you at.
I'll sign anything
at Waterstones Hull.
I'd be only too pleased to do a book signing in Waterstones Hull.
There we go. Hope we can. But James, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time. I'm sure our listeners found that fascinating, and obviously you can be heard on the Continent every week and absolutely no other podcasts at all. And people can see you on TV as well and read all your stuff in the various different publications you work for. So thank you very much for coming in, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Pleasure.
This episode of Ramble Meets was sponsored by Bet365.
This was a Radio Staccato production.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.